You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Thank you very much for coming. This, as you know, is an event with our fellow, capital and small F, Yevgeny Morozov, on cyber warfare. It's his second brown bag here. So with that, I hand things off to Yevgeny.
Thank you, Lenny. Well, we circulated an article that I wrote for The Economist a few months ago on cyber warfare. I don't know if all of you have read it. I'll try to summarize some of the points I've made there and adding some of the new developments on this issue and do so in maybe 20, 25 minutes. And I hope we'll have a productive discussion afterwards because it's a very complex issue which brings together a lot of disciplines, law, technology, political science, geopolitics, security, computer science, you name it. So, I mean, it's a very challenging topic. So, I'll try to be brief and then we can maybe flesh out some of the conceptual challenges in Q&A. So I think the biggest challenge in understanding what cyber warfare is and why it actually matters has to do with lack of any workable definition of cyber warfare in international law. We hear about cyber warfare and cyber wars constantly. Almost on a daily basis, you'll find references to cyber warfare in the media. You know, pick up any newspaper and you'll see references to cyber attacks from China on the U.S. You'll see references to, the cyber war between Israeli and Palestine and Arab hackers going on, accompanying the actual war effort. We've all heard about the cyber war between Russia and Georgia, Russia and Estonia. This stuff is more or less in the news, right? And just to give you a rough indication of how much is at stake, I'll just quote you a figure of the actual market for cybersecurity in the U.S. I mean, the market is growing at 8 to 10% and it's projected to be around $13 billion by 2011. So, I mean, it's a huge industry with a lot of money involved, and obviously a lot of this growth is driven by public fear and concern about sort of what cyber warfare has in store for governments, right? So let's try to play a little bit with the definition, because I think this is very crucial to understand what's actually involved in, cyber war, right? And if you look at the media, all of those reports which I just referenced, you'll see that a lot of other terms tend to be conflated with cyber warfare, right, with cyber war in general. You'll hear that, cyber terrorism, cyber espionage, cyber crime, are just some of the sort of three, four phenomena which are used together with cyber warfare almost interchangeably, right? There is very little distinction, at least when cyber warfare is being discussed in the media, between, say, cyber terrorism and cyber warfare, right? And it partly reflects sort of confusion and the blurring of lines between war and terrorism in general. But a lot of this, I think, is has to do with cyberspace and the conceptual difficulties of, trying to apply the traditional rules of warfare and terrorism to cyberspace. It's a very challenging process. And in that article which you've got, I talk about the so-called translation problems, right? And because there is no international, there is no definition of cyber warfare in international law, we have to more or less take the rules of conventional warfare and try to apply them to cyberspace, right? And of course, there is no one-to-one translation for every term, and there is no one-to-one sort of translation for the major norms guiding it, right? So what some analysts have proposed is to sort of speak of cyber warfare only when there is an actual war involved, right? So for cyber warfare to exist, you actually need to have some sort of an armed conflict going on. Everything else should be treated as cyber terrorism, cyber crime, cyber espionage, or whatever, right? And I think it's a very useful perspective to adopt. And I'll tell you why later in the lecture, but I think you have to keep in mind this crucial requirement, which I think is very useful. We do need to have an actual war to speak about cyber warfare. Everything else has to be labeled otherwise, and it has to be dealt with using completely different set of legal norms and definitions than sort of warfare, right? Another, I think, crucial element for you to keep in mind before we sort of jump in into the technicalities is that you could also make an argument that cyber warfare per se is not really that new, right? And that's also something I reference in the article quite a bit. The fact that we say that it's cyber doesn't necessarily mean that it's new. You know, technology has always played a role in warfare, you know, throughout history. So there has always been, the use of the telegraph or the use of the radio or the use of television, all of that stuff, you know, has been around for, you know, centuries, right? You know, a century at least. So we don't have to really think that this is something qualitatively new just because it has cyber in front of it, right? We have dealt with the challenges posed by the telegraph, you know, which was used actually during the American Civil War, right? It was cut. You know, it's more or less the analog of, the cyber attacks we see today. It's, you know, radio jamming during the war between Russia and Japan in 1905 was also more or less the first example of a new phenomenon, you know, radio jamming. That was the first time it was used. And you can make the same arguments that it was also sort of part of, you know, cyber warfare, right? Now some of those operations have shifted to cyberspace, so that's sort of logical, right? So keep in mind those two perspectives, that A, we need the war for cyber war to exist, cyber warfare to exist, and we also need to remember that it's not so new qualitatively and sort of historically, right? So let's just, now that we have tried to at least play with the definitions a little bit, let's try to think what would actually constitute cyber warfare, right? What would actually be some of the activities that need to take place for cyber warfare to exist, right? And I think it's very useful to separate most cyber attacks into two big sort of cohorts, right? So there are two kinds of attacks. And I'll explain shortly what they mean and how they differ and, you know, why they're important. There are so-called routing-based attacks and traffic-based attacks, right? And I'll be sort of, if something is not clear, you should ask now, you know, and sort of stop me and interrupt, because it's not very technical. I'll try to make it accessible, but some of it may not seem that clear. You know, I wouldn't go into the technicalities of how, you know, internet protocols work and how the actual communication on the network happens, but it would be suffice to say that, you know, when you're trying to access something through a browser, your browser needs to follow some directions established sort of on the internet, right? It has to communicate with, first you have to communicate with the internet service provider, then, you know, it has to look up the URL in its sort of little, you know, yellow pages, whatever, right? So there are a lot of directions involved in this process, right? So routing-based attacks would more or less try to manipulate those directions, right? So imagine it as somebody has just gone and replaced, you know, road signs on a road that you're traveling on with a car, right? And in order to mislead you and get you somewhere else, right? So that would be what would normally make, what would normally be thought of as routing-based attacks, right? But then there is another kind, which I think is much more prominent and much more often discussed in the media. It's so-called traffic-based attacks, right? And what happens in traffic-based attacks is that, you know, the system which underlies internet communications is just being used much more heavily than usual, right? So now that we've sort of started using this road metaphor, think about it as, you know, 100 cars passing on a road as opposed to 5, right, which put much more pressure on the road or bridge or whatever, you know, they're traveling on, right? So it's much more heavy than usual use of the underlying infrastructure. And I'll just give you one more example to sort of, for you to be able to grasp this concept. You know, you've all seen yesterday during the inauguration that there were around, what, a few million, 2 million people somewhere in D.C., right? And they were all gathered more or less in one place. And most of them were using mobiles, or at least had mobiles on them, right? And now mobile networks, they're not really built for this type of heavy use. You know, whenever you look at those whatever cellular towels, right, which actually you know, help us use the mobile technologies, they're never meant to be used by 2 million people who all congregate in one place, right? So yesterday there were a lot of concerns that the mobile networks may not actually be able to handle all the communications people were making, because they're just not built for that. They're supposed to be much more spread and decentralized, right? So, and of course, all of that happened voluntarily. People showed up, and that's why it happened. But imagine if that happened because, you know, somebody stole all their mobile phones, brought them to one place, and started calling, placing calls from all of them at the same time, right? That would probably crash the entire system, right? Because it was never built for such heavy use. Right. This is more or less what happens with traffic-based cyber attacks. You know, and again, on a very naive and sort of user level, you know, you all access websites, right? And you all know that sometimes there are dozens of people, or hundreds of people, or millions of people accessing those websites at the same time, right? And of course, each server knows how much it can handle. But imagine if artificially, suddenly somebody starts selling 10 times the usual amount of traffic to those websites. So it's not just 100 people who visit it, you know, per second as usual, but now it's suddenly 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000, right? And of course, servers are not built to handle that type of you know, quantity of demand, right? So what's happening is that basically slows down the server, right? It slows down how fast information is being served to everyone, right? So whether you are participating in a cyber attack or not, more or less, you are also the victim, because, you know, whenever you try to access a website and it's not loading, chances are it's overwhelmed, right? And if you really look at, you know, the type of attacks that are most often discussed in the media, they are exactly this type. They're called denial of service. You know, and it's because service more or less is being denied. There is nothing sort of fancy about the definition. It just sort of tells you that, you know, the usual service is not available. Just like it wouldn't be available with your mobile network, it's not available with your cell phone, right? And sometimes, of course, you can overwhelm the sites and the servers up to such a point that they will crash completely, right? So they will not just, whatever, get slow. They may just, you know, meltdown, right? So that doesn't happen that often, but again, that's a possibility. That may not just be delay, it may actually be complete destruction. So denial of service attacks, right? For them to be effective, as you understand, you know, there have to be many participants in them, right? A lot of people, a lot of computers, a lot of mobile phones, a lot of whatever have to be sending their demands at the same time, right? And it's very difficult to make that happen without sort of any outside intervention, right? It happened in DC, you know, once and whatever in a lifetime, right? There's so many people gathered. If you wanted to do that sort of, you know, strategically, because you wanted to, what you would need to do is sort of make sure that you can coordinate 1,000 to 1 million computers all send requests to the server at the same time, right? That would make sort of the most sense. Or have all cell phones call the same number at the same time, right? So this is what happens in the... So attacks get distributed, so to say, right? So they become distributed denial of service attacks. And this is the most frequent type. So what happens is that whenever you browse the web, right, you don't usually know of every little single software that is being downloaded on your computer. Right. So sometimes, and again, all of you have seen viruses and malware and spyware, you're more or less aware of all the stuff. So whenever you're visiting a website, let's say, which, you know, may have a security breach or security compromise, it may install a little piece of software on your computer, right? Which would not be detected because it was sitting so low in the computer hierarchy that your antivirus software would not actually detect it. So this little piece of software sits on your computer, it's not detected by anything, and you don't know that it actually, you know, sits on your computer. What the software does is it allows somebody else to take control of your computer and do whatever they want with it, right? What's called a Trojan, normally, right? So you may actually never notice that this thing is there because it doesn't cause any visible destruction. it doesn't necessarily have to destroy your computers, destroy your files, whatever. It may, all it may be doing is sending a little request to open a particular URL every now and then, right? And you wouldn't even be noticing that. And just to give you some sense of how widespread this problem is, the estimates are that from 15 to 25% of all computers which are online are actually part of a botnet of one sort, right, or another. So chances are that every fourth computer on the internet is actually part of a botnet, whether actively or passively. You know, it doesn't have to be, you know, you would only know that you're part of a botnet if some activity starts, right? So if you're part of a botnet and no request to serve any web pages are being sent, you know, it's dormant and you wouldn't know it, but you're still part of it, right? So one fourth, more or less, of all online computers. Right? So it is very prevalent. But what happens is that there is a command and control center, which basically decides what to do with your computer and when to do it, right? So imagine I have sort of this little program on my computer. Bipasha has it, Lenny has it, we all have it, we don't know about it. And then there is one little command and control center, right, which decides that at 5 o'clock on, you know, on a Friday, all of our computers have to send a request to opensource.org, right? So without our knowledge, our computers sort of somewhere in the background are trying to access source.org. You know, with three computers, it doesn't really matter, right? We are built to handle, you know, three requests per time. It's not really a big deal. But imagine if there are a million of us, right? And a million of us are being asked to open a particular, to send the request to serve a particular web page, right? And that, of course, can crash the server. Of course, it can slow down the service for everyone else, right? And our computers are called a botnet, right? So we have become part of a botnet. And you see, and botnet basically means, you know, net of robots, if you really want to sort of look at the sort of origin of the word. But what we have become is basically a net of computers which whose activity can then be directed to do whatever our command and control center wants. It used to be very easy to, relatively easy, to fight such botnets. All you had to do was more or less to disable the command and control center. And once it's sort of striking down, once it's gone, nothing would happen to my or her or his computer because our sort of master is gone, right? So all that needed to be done was to identify this command and control center and sort of make sure that it gets offline or is being destroyed. What now is actually possible is for the command and control center to... for me to become a command and control center, or for Bipasha to become a command and control center, or for Lenny's computer, right? So now you have so-called peer-to-peer botnets, right? So if you strike down one command and control center, any computer that is infected, which is part of that network, can suddenly become the new command and control center. So more or less it becomes uncontrollable. You can't really go and strike down the computer which you think is responsible for all of this, because then he can pass on his status to another one. So from a slave sort of in the system, you become the master. Right? So now it has become possible and is widely practiced. Most of the recent botnets actually are built on this peer-to-peer architecture. Right? So that's what happens in a typical distributed denial of service attack. There is a botnet, you know, they attack a particular site, take it down, slow it down, it becomes inaccessible. Right. I wouldn't go too deep into the routing-based attacks because they're not really so prevalent. So, you know, if you have questions, we can come back to this. So, denial of service attacks are traffic-based attacks, right? So that's the other kind. Now, of course, we have all seen and heard and read about other types of attacks. You know, of all those very talented mad scientists sitting in the basement and trying to hack into the Pentagon or banks or whatever, right? All of that has been featured prominently in the media and the popular culture. Again, it's very hard to find a category which would describe what exactly those attacks are. If it is merely stealing data from, you know, the government networks, then it may be useful to term it cyber espionage, right? Or if it's just a matter of stealing money or whatever, to call it cybercrime or whatever, right? But it's very hard for us to use the word attack to describe the loss of this sort of somebody stealing data, and also describe the physical destruction of a server, to describe the delaying in the how information is being served, right? So it's very hard to talk about cyber attacks as one big universal concept, right? So now that, and again, if you look at what happens with, you know, when you're trying to attack a bank, for example, right? You're just going, guessing somebody's password, right? And you're going and transferring the money somewhere, right? By breaking into an online banking system, right? Again, what exactly is cyber about this, right? You could, like in the past, would go guess the code or the password of a safe or a bank vault and would enter and do it physically. You wouldn't really say that there is something really qualitatively new about the process only because it's on the internet now, right? So again, we have to keep in mind a lot of historical background to what exactly is new and what exactly is not new about this. But anyway, let's just move on and see how this has been applied in practice. Because up till 2007, most of the discussions about cyber warfare and cyber attacks, they have been more or less residing in the realm of theory and sort of what if hypothesis making, and not in the actual sort of empirical evidence, right? They, of course, there have been attacks on the governments, on the State Department, on banks, all of that happened, but it wasn't really on a scale in which you could really start using the word cyber war, cyber warfare. So the first really big example of cyber warfare would be the attacks on Estonia in the spring of 2007. Right, and I'll just refresh your memory if you have forgotten what happened. There was a big argument, public argument, between Estonia and Russia over the fate of a historical monument in Tallinn. Right, the authorities wanted to move it. Russians said we don't want to move it, and suddenly Estonia found itself under a very huge wave of cyber attacks. Right, and those cyber attacks, they paralyzed a lot of the some of the public services, right? So, for example, the websites of major Estonian banks were attacked, right? And they were, they were relying on distributed denial of service attacks, which I've just described, right? So they may have slowed down the services, the online services of those banks, right? And since a lot of them were coming from abroad, the only way to sort of safeguard against these attacks was to limit access to these online banking systems only to citizens of Estonia, only to IP addresses, only to computers with Estonian sort of geographic location, right? So a lot of Estonians living abroad, for example, couldn't do anything with their online banking accounts because, you know, any foreign access was blocked because that's where all the sort of requests to serve pages were coming from, right? So and the biggest sort of consequence, which everyone now uses anecdotally, is that their 911 emergency service was down for an hour or two as a result of the attacks because there have been, I guess, some errors in the system which operated it because of the cyber attacks, right? So that the argument is that, you know, since 911 was down, you know, it's a major calamity, you know, of big national proportions, right? So, and again, those of you who haven't been to Estonia, you know, you have to be aware that the internet is a really big thing there. I mean, they made access to the internet a basic human right in 2000, right? So it's really a big national issue, right? So what Estonians did, and I think this is very interesting, they actually tried to build an argument, tried to make a case that those attacks were actually part in the beginning of an armed conflict. So they actually asked NATO to help them deal with this issue as a matter of national and, you know, consequently international security, right? So, and of course, you know that NATO has, you know, collective defense agreement, right? So technically, an attack against Estonia means that, you know, it's an attack against the whole of NATO, right? So that was an argument which they put forward, saying that we've been attacked, you know, we have to do something. And we'll come back to discuss it because it's a very interesting legal question. I'll just move on to describe what happened in Georgia. And then just let me just backtrack a little bit to Estonia. Nobody knows who was behind the attacks, right? A lot of them came from Russia. So a lot of you could actually look at the data sort of geographically and see where they're coming from. There was no evidence that they have been sanctioned or arranged by the Russian authorities. So there is no proof whatsoever. The only evidence of the Russian state involvement was that one of the computers which was participating in those attacks had the IP address of the Russian government. So an employee of a Russian government, whatever. So it wasn't somewhere in the defense ministry, whatever, just one of the computers. But again, you have to keep in mind that for any, you know, I've described the botnets, right? The botnet might have up to whatever, a million computers, right? So it's not really unusual, statistically speaking, for a computer of the Russian government to be part of that botnet, right? So it doesn't necessarily prove that it was an organized effort and somebody systematically wanted to, whatever, attack or destroy Estonia, right? So what happened in Georgia was slightly different, both from technological and from legal perspectives. First of all, there was a war already going on in Georgia, right? So in Estonia, there was no wars, there was no armed conflict, just had a bunch of cyber attacks, and people said, let's treat them as war. In Georgia, you already actually had a war, right? So what happened is that the war was going on, and also you had cyber attacks going on, right? Which some people have used this opportunity to discuss what cyber attacks would be allowed and which wouldn't be allowed under the law of war, right? Because in wartime, you can make an argument that, you know, you can actually use them strategically for military purposes, and then you have to really restrict yourself by the Geneva Conventions, you know, the additional protocols and everything else. And I'll also talk about that. The most interesting development in the Georgian case was that a lot of volunteers on the Russian side could actually go and install a bunch of software on their computers and actually facilitate the sort of cyber warfare effort, right? So you could actually voluntarily turn your computer into a botnet of sorts. So if you really thought that your contribution to this big cyber warfare effort is needed by your motherland, you can just go and follow the instructions and, you know, install a bunch of software and actually launch those cyber attacks from your computer. And I wrote an article for Slate and in August actually documenting all the steps I've taken. I've sort of decided to go through the reporting route and actually install all the software and sort of see what happens. You know, and it was a big deal because that was the first time when you could actually, you know, based on your ideological, nationalistic, whatever, you know, likings, you could actually go and participate in war effort remotely, right? At least that was sort of the big conceptual framework here. As I found out after I wrote the article a few months later, is that it actually didn't really matter that much. I mean, my efforts as of a cyber warrior, whatever, a person with a computer, they were not really as effective as the actions of a botnet. In part because if you have 100 to 1,000 people like me, it's still very hard for us to coordinate the attacks time-wise and, you know, collaboration-wise. And for cyber attacks to be effective, they all have to come at the same time because that the scale matters, right? So when you have a command and control center, which just says 1 million computers immediately start an attack, that's much more effective than 1,000 people sort of deciding, let's just go and attack Estonia and installing a bunch of software and choosing the targets and then clicking, you know, start, right? So it turned out not to be as effective, but it was a lot of fun. I mean, the Russian blog was sort of full of people being very happy, saying that, wow, we're sort of participating, this is cool. So it was more of a soft way for people to share, to sort of feel that they are belonging to something bigger and sort of have some shared feelings. Now I'll come back to this issue. This is, by the way, this sort of collective effort of people trying to become botnets is now called meatbots. So it's sort of real people as opposed to sort of just technology. What happened after Georgia, I think the last anecdote I'll describe, was the cyber dimension to the war in Gaza, to the recent events. What happened there, that there was a huge information war going on. And again, this is something which I failed to notice at the beginning. You know, information war is also one of the terms which we usually conflate with cybercrime, cyberterrorism, cyber warfare, and whatever. We used to almost use them interchangeably, but information war is something very different. You know, it's using all sorts of media for basic ideological propaganda, right? So it could be radio, could be TV, could be blogs, could be leaflets you drop from the sky, whatever, right? So there was a lot of information warfare. You know, the Israeli foreign ministry was recruiting bloggers to advance their own viewpoint by leaving comments on English language and Arabic language blogs, even, right? So there was a systematic effort to actually manipulate public opinion. But again, this is not new stuff that anyone would, you know, just because it's on blogs doesn't mean that there is something actually, you know, new about it. That has been happening in other media as well, right? Not just the blogosphere. What I found interesting about the actual cyber warfare effort was that there was something similar to what we saw in Georgia, that you could actually go and participate in cyber attacks on your own, right? So you could download, well, there is a very interesting site, you can go check it out, called Help Israel Win. And it's a site where you can basically go, and it has like five or six languages, so you know you don't have to speak English. Only you can go download a little software, which basically you just click start, and then it does something. You have no idea what exactly it's doing, right? And I'll just give you a comparison to what was happening in the Georgian case. In the Georgian case, they also advertised like three or four different computer programs which you could use to launch those cyber attacks, right? But all that software was sort of very transparent. It's available on the market. You can go see what it's code like. You can actually know what it's actually doing. You can be safe using it, right? So all you had to do was download it, insert the target link that you want to attack, click start, and we'll be sending, you know, ping requests or whatever to the actual site, right? So that was the Georgian case. In this case, with Israel, you would download the program, you know, have no idea what it's doing, click start, and then the sort of the background on the website says it's a program which was designed by, you know, Israeli students who want to support the war effort. And then a lot of tech people started actually looking into what exactly the software was doing. And, you know, there was a very big suspicion that it's actually, you know, spyware and malware, which is actually also spying on what you're doing online and sending some of the data to whoever, you know, is behind the software. So a lot of people found it very suspicious that you can actually download this little piece of software thinking that you're helping the war effort while, you know, your online banking information is being stolen at the same time and sent somewhere else. Yeah. So, I mean, that's what happened in the most recent. That was Lainey who made that comment, by the way, just for the tape recording. So that was what happened in the most recent example of cyber warfare. But now, actually, I would like to go back to some of the legal questions which were raised here, right? Particularly with the Estonian case. In the Georgian case later. In the Estonian case, what we basically saw with the government, which tried to make an argument saying that cyber attacks were the beginning of an armed conflict. You know, and I'm not a lawyer, so you know, if you are sort of expert in international law, it may sound too naive, but I mean, there are international treaties guiding what is and what is not the beginning of an armed conflict. Right, so I mean, you have the United Nations treaties, right? You have all sorts of other documents in international law which regulate what counts as the beginning of a war and what doesn't, right? So none of them, of course, extend to cyber attacks, right? So it's very hard to sort of take that, you know, Article 51 of, you know, of the UN and say, now this is how we think it should apply to cyberspace. That interpretation hasn't happened, right? So, of course, we have to sort of, countries and governments have to figure out whether a cyber attack on, you know, your national airport website counts as cyber or not. You know, if it's a website which has no value whatsoever,
Probably it doesn't. If it's somehow linked to data about flights, any of the navigational data, which might potentially result in casualties, then, of course, it's a completely different matter. You know, for example, I don't know, the last Brownback, we talked about this case with Google News erroneously publishing a story about United Airlines stock collapsing. Right. The story was from 2002, but it got republished in 2008, and that caused a very significant fall in the prices of United Airlines. Now, if you could actually go and attack Google News website or manipulate Google system to republish five articles of this sort, all reporting on the companies from the same sector, you know, it may cause a very big fall in the financial markets. Right? So then the question is, you know, how do you treat soft issues like this? If somebody goes and attacks the, you know, web infrastructure of New York Stock Exchange, you know, and that causes, you know, financial panic, how should you react to this? Right? And I think the right way, and of course, we can sort of do a lot of hypothetical what ifs. The key question that Estonians, I think, didn't ask, and they should have, was could you actually attribute these attacks to a state? Because, you know, again, if you look at the international legal documents, what you would find is that you do need this attribution. If this attribution doesn't exist, it means that you have to treat these issues as crime and terrorism, right? And if you do treat it as crime and terrorism, you can't really speak about the war. Estonia needs to go after Russian citizens or whatever citizens who have, you know, attacked their web infrastructure, right? So attribution here is particularly important, and this is something which is very hard to prove in cyberspace, right? Because it's just hard. And just to give you one more interesting factoid, I spoke about this botnets, right? So there are these millions of computers which, you know, can, you know, direct request to a particular site at a particular time. You could actually now go and rent such botnets. So, you know, if you want to wage a cyber attack, you could actually go and buy, you know, I want to have 50,000 computers in my botnet, all, you know, situated there and there and doing this and this. You could actually go and, you know, pay market rates for this and get it. Of course, it would not be legal, but that's possible, right? And that there is a sort of a market in this which already exists. So this brings us to another question. It's the difficulty of linking governments to a lot of private gangs, cyber gangs, which actually exist and make a lot of money in this business. I mean, cyber extortion is a growing industry globally, you know, and it basically what it means is that you have a lot of this very educated cyber criminals who basically terrorize companies and blackmail them and ask them to pay up to avoid future attacks. You know, so imagine you're a small startup and then you are getting all those wonderful, you know, attacks against your website, and what they're basically asking you is, you know, pay us $5,000 and we'll stop the attacks, right? So if you're really entrepreneurial, you know, you don't really have to build your own botnet. You just go buy it at a lower cost, you know, wage your attacks and, you know, and charge more to avoid them, right? So, I mean, there are all sorts of arbitrage opportunities here as well. Anyhow, but it's very hard to link the governments to these gangs. I mean, you see a lot of stuff written about the Chinese cyber warfare effort, about, you know, the Chinese hackers. I mean, they do exist. There are no memos signed by the National Defense, whatever, administration saying that, you know, we authorize the Russian cyber gang to do this and this, right? So, and until we can prove it, it will be very hard to treat it as actual war, as we've seen in Estonia. What I think was interesting from this perspective in the Georgian case was what you could actually do with cyber attacks once a war has begun. Because in Georgia, it was different because there was already a conflict going on, right? And again, here you have all sorts of international documents and treaties regulating this. I mean, you have the Geneva Conventions and the additional protocols, most importantly, which are sort of documenting what you can and what you cannot do in wartime, both as a commander and, you know, as a civilian. Right, and here it also reveals, and again, they do apply to cyberspace, whether we want it or not. We may have difficulty translating the actual prescriptions and the actual, you know, articles of the Geneva Conventions, but nobody has canceled them for cyberspace. I mean, it doesn't mean that just because it's online, you know, the usual rules wouldn't apply. So just give you an example. I mean, whenever you are, if you are a military person and you are considering a cyber attack, you know, if you're a Russian commander, you're considering a cyber attack on Georgia, right? Of course, you are also, you're still guided by three main by three main criteria, right? And those are, you know, you have to distinguish military and civilian, between military and civilian targets, right? So you have to make sure that you only go after military objects as much as you can, right? You have to make sure that you balance the military necessity with sort of humanitarian needs, right? The humanitarian demands. So, you know, you have to make sure that you choose your weapons appropriately, right, for a particular attack. And you have to make sure that your attacks are proportional, right? So you have to make sure that you avoid unnecessary suffering at sort of all possible costs. And if you look at cyber attacks as a concept, it's very hard to meet those three criteria with cyber attacks. First of all, internet is a dual-use space, right? And what it means is that it's used by civilians and the military alike. Right. So if you're saying that we just want to go after the Georgian military and we know that they have a very sophisticated web communication system, you know, you can't really go after the internet because you know that by default there are civilians hanging out on email and chat rooms and whatever, right? So the requirement to separate, you know, military and civilian objectives is very hard to meet, right? Another point here is that it's very hard to predict the actual consequences of a cyber attack. Right. And as we've seen, I think even with the Estonian case, I don't think that the attack on, for example, the 9/11 emergency service was planned. It was probably the result of a much lower level attack against a particular server or website. Right. And then it triggered a chain of events, which eventually led to, you know, 911 service going down. Right. So there is a very significant snowball effect here that, you know, cyber attack against one server can actually result in a lot of other destruction, which is very hard to predict and you cannot control it. So it's very hard to argue that in this case, cyber attacks are a very good weapon that you would actually want to use as a commander, right? And the two last points is that it's also very hard to justify them in terms of military needs and military necessity. Particularly if you look at Georgia, it's very hard. I mean, if you look at the websites before the attacks, I mean, all the government websites were not necessarily the best sort of, you know, they're not necessarily very useful, right? So it's very hard to argue that you have to go and attack websites of your enemy just because you can. I mean, there has still to be some military objective and military need behind it. And it's very hard to prove that those websites have actually been updated, you know, before the war, you know, 6 months before the war, whatever. It's very hard to actually make a case that they are strategic assets that have to be attacked. And the last point here is that we almost never think about cyber warfare as something positive, right? And it's very hard to visualize that as a positive force. But it may actually be a more humane way to fight wars if you think about it, right? Because, you know, in traditional, using conventional sort of weaponry, all you have to do is sort of go and bomb a building, and, you know, it will physically destruct it. It may kill people, it may also cause a lot of civilian destruction. With cyber attacks, you can actually go and disable, you know, a military train depot, right? You can disable the navigation system for 2 hours. You can also turn it on afterwards. No people are killed. And it's actually, you know, pretty useful in terms of, you know, saving unnecessary casualties, right? So, and again, if you look at the traditional military doctrines, they actually require you to use more humane weapons once you have used them, right? So if you have used cyber attacks once and they have proved more humane, you're actually bound to use them every other time, right, that you're facing similar situation. And I don't think that a lot of military people would actually like to restrain themselves by cyber attacks only. So I think I'll stop here in terms of sort of legal technological stuff. We have some time, right?
I guess the question is the following. Like, if I understood correctly, yeah. you say that the involvement of state is very difficult to prove. Uh-huh. Then, if it is almost impossible to prove that, how would the UN conventions and Geneva conventions that are about armed conflict between mm-hmm. the states will apply? I mean, how would that connection be ever be met?
Sure. Well, when I was talking about the state, what I meant was more a reference to the Estonian case, where you didn't really yet have a war, right? And you just had a public squabbling or whatever, right? And then attacks happened, and then the question is, could you really count it at the beginning of an armed conflict in following states? When you're looking at Russia and Georgia, for example, the war which did take place, here the question is, why wouldn't they use cyberspace? The assumption is that they would be because that's where, communications happen. So I don't think here it's not really a question of how would you prove it. The default assumption is that the parties to armed conflict would use any weaponry available to them, including cyber attacks or including cyberspace, right? So this is what would trigger the international treaties.
So basically, but if you don't prove, then how, I mean, you assume, right? But how can you apply any laws to assumption?
No. But you see, you don't have to prove. Well, how should
maybe
I say it?
Maybe I didn't formulate the question right.
Well, look, I mean, not necessarily everyone, in an armed conflict uses walkie-talkies, right? But we still know that it's a means of communication and it can be used in an armed conflict, right? The same or less as with the internet, you can target it to whatever, knock it down. You can use it proactively for intelligence gathering. That was actually an argument made by some analysts in, Russian-Georgian conflict was that and it's made on a much global scale, is that when you're actually trying to use cyber attacks to slow down the internet infrastructure of your enemy, you're actually hurting your own intelligence gathering. Because, if you do have functioning networks with data travels, you can actually try to intercept it, gather it, act on it, study it for future research. And when you're just trying to knock out the internet in its entirety, it may be useful for some purposes, but for others it's not. So, I mean, in this particular case, you don't really have to prove anything, frankly. You just assume that the armies would be relying on this as...
Yeah, I understand that, but for instance, say there is an armed conflict or something, and there's a bunch of cyber attack happening.
Mm-hmm.
How would you attribute them to the state? You just assume that this is state, but what if it's not? Or the state might be behind whatever the civilian gangs, but
mm-hmm.
if you want
mm-hmm.
to apply laws to that,
mm-hmm.
wouldn't the assumption be not enough?
No, of course not. I mean, so you would need to prove attribution if you want to take those people to court.
Well,
that's more or less... But again, you need to have something which would be guiding it, because what I'm actually trying to say was... Some of the arguments I put forward is that why we haven't seen so many cyber attacks on behalf of the state yet is because there is regulation already, and they would be constrained by the international legal norms if they do it publicly, and if they do it. And that's actually a very good point about civilians. If you actually look at what the private individuals can do in a wartime, it's also guided by the Geneva Conventions and the additional protocols. Because what you can actually say is that if I am allowing my computer to participate in cyber attacks, or if I'm doing it on behalf of whatever, Russia, as a participant to a conflict, and I'm sitting in Moscow, whatever, I'm actually participating in hostilities as a civilian, which again triggers a lot of interesting questions in international law, because technically, if you could prove that I'm directly participating in hostilities, I should be prosecuted for war crimes.
But basically, it's like the state can do something, like the government, that it will never be...
You see, but there is no reason for the states to, when there is a war going on, there is no reason to hide it, because it's allowed. You're immune from persecution in the wartime if you are a war combatant. You don't really have to hide anything. You can actually say, this is our cyber strategy, we actually want to go and start fighting. So it's not like it's prohibited. It's just that it's very hard to attain the precision. You would need to use it effectively. It's not like a rocket which you can 100% and it will sort of destroy particular, well, and we know how it works also, and I know how it doesn't work. It's not like you can be precise and target something. As I've said, since it's a dual-use space, you don't really know whom you might be hurting by launching cyber attacks. It could be civilians. You know, again, it's very hard to make an argument that the fact that I can't access my email is the same as having my house destroyed by a rocket, you know, as a civilian. So, you know, a lot of questions here are, I think, very hard. But the governments are not, and some analysts, actually, some legal analysts, have proposed that we have to get rid of all this uncertainty by actually coming up with a new international treaties on information operations and actually outline what states can and cannot do. And some people say it would actually result in more cyber warfare, because right now this uncertainty actually constrains them. And some people say it would result in less cyber warfare, because, you know, they would know what's allowed and what's not allowed, and we'll be doing it openly. It's, you know, it's confusing, but that's how it is.
Just to follow up on that a little bit, how are, like, states responding to this kind of a threat? Because as we've been kind of discussing, the combination of the restrictions on cyber warfare and its benefits kind of, like, mean that it's not going to be states often that are acting. It's these individuals or kind of collectives that are very hard to kind of prosecute and probably also kind of defend against, right? It's much easier maybe to fight something that's coming from a Department of Defense server, because at least you know where it's coming from, than if it's coming from, you know, 8 million individual computers, you know. Where are things going as far as kind of deterrence or fighting it?
Sure. Well, I mean, it's a big debate now happening, actually. Again, and here you have a lot of the traditional tensions between, as I've said, intelligence gathering and more offensive operations. You know, I referenced it in the article. There was a very interesting proposal, well, interesting in quotation marks, made last year by one of the colonels in the U.S. Army, who basically wrote a big article saying that the U.S. should build its own botnet, right, made of discarded computers, government computers. You know, so all the computers which are retired by the U.S. government every year would actually go and collect them, build a network out of them, and then we would direct that network to attack our enemies, just like our enemies are doing, you know, unto us. You know, I think it's a misguided effort because, again, it's very hard to find who your enemies actually are, you know, and it's with this capacity available to buy in the open market, you can actually go and, you know, and once they strike down one computer, you know, one botnet, you can rely on another. I think what we haven't seen much of yet is actually better defensive thinking how you can better defect your networks, how you can minimize damage, how you can prioritize which networks are important, which networks are not. You know, because if, you know, even in the Estonian case, maybe 5, 7, 9 websites were really crucial and others were not crucial. So how do you actually figure out which are and which are not, and how do you protect that? You know, I think we are not really having a very substantial debate either in the U.S. or, you know, outside on these issues, in part because there is a lot of fear-mongering, and a lot of these fears are generated by cybersecurity companies, you know, whose business it is to sell us antivirus software. You know, so it's in their best interest to have this atmosphere of fear in which they cultivate this myth, you know, about cyber warfare being very destructive. But again, you know, I still don't see the smoking gun. You know, if you look at Georgia, for example, and you look at the destruction caused in Georgia, I mean, I would say it was minimal. You know, it wasn't that great by military or any other standards. But the thing is that if you try to apply the kind of damages that happened to Georgia, if you try to apply them to, you know, California or Texas or whatever, nobody would notice them, because Georgia is, so to say, cyber locked. You know, it has one sort of pipeline going through Turkey, and again, the internet is, you know, we forget, but it's still about physical infrastructure. So the better your physical infrastructure, you know, the more secure your connections are, right? So, and if your infrastructure is robust enough, And again, that involves laying out cable, satellite, internet. That's all expensive stuff. But the more robust your infrastructure is, the more secure you are. So, you know, in Georgia's case, since they didn't have much of it, of course they felt those cyber attacks. You know, in the U.S., most of those cyber attacks would not even be felt. So a lot of this, I think, is overblown, and a lot of this is overhyped. There are dangers, but it's nothing that would require, you know, a new task force or a new, you know, Star Wars to open, which I think would actually happen with so much fear in the public sphere.
Shane, I have a question. I wonder whether such tools as cyber wars and stuff have ever been used by companies, competing companies, let's say, or big corporations, you know.
Uh-huh.
Is that
uh-huh.
something that happens, or it's mm-hmm. practically mm-hmm. impossible mm-hmm. for whatever reason?
No, I mean, it is, well, I mean, legally, of course, it's impossible, but, I mean, practically, it is possible. I can't think of many examples of actual big Western firms doing that. And again, most of it is happening undercover. You know, you don't really know if it's, you know, a cyber extortion gang based somewhere in Thailand or whatever, which is doing this to you, or whether it's your competitor hiring the cyber extortion gang to do it just to slow you down, right? So the very interesting case, I wouldn't go into details. I mean, there is a practice called click fraud, which may mean many different things, but one of the direct examples to illustrate it would be, you know, when you search on Google, you see search results, but also you see sponsored links somewhere to the right, right? And you know that once you click on that sponsored link, that the person who put that link there actually has to pay to Google. So that's how it works. They don't have to pay unless somebody clicks on it. So what was happening in the business world was that competing firms started hiring special units to actually do as many searches as they can on their competitors and clicking on those links to bankrupt them, because, you know, you'll be faced with, you know, $5,000 bill to Google if somebody clicks on your link every hour, right? So that definitely happened, and that's happening constantly. I think it's a problem for startups and entrepreneurs more than it is for big corporations, because, you know, you would really need, you know, Google wouldn't take your checks, so it would just understand that it's a fraud if it's real of a big scale. What I should mention here, which I haven't, is that we see more and more, and that doesn't have much to do with business, but still we see more and more cyber warfare and cyber attacks being used to stifle free speech and to really crack down on sort of dissenting voices. I think this is an issue which is probably most relevant to SI, and, you know, maybe, you know, our colleagues from the Burma Project can comment on what's happening there in the space, because, you know, it's an issue. I'll give you, you know, I gave that example a few months ago when we had the discussion on the new media in authoritarian states, but anyhow, in Russia, for example, there was this very interesting blogger on LiveJournal who was blogging about Georgia, South Ossetia, all the sort of very geopolitical stuff with a very critical perspective on Russia. And he was blogging on LiveJournal. What started happening at some point is that suddenly, overnight, there was a series of very serious cyber attacks on his blog. And since it's on LiveJournal also. And LiveJournal is a big blogging platform in Russia. And what basically happened is that the attacks were so huge and so massive that it forced the entire LiveJournal to go down for, like, you know, 5 hours internationally. So they managed to take the entire platform down because there was no other way to fix it. And what actually happened is that a lot of people got very angry with this guy, you know, particularly users who don't speak Russian, who don't follow affairs, you know, in Georgia. You know, if you're sitting in California and you're using LiveJournal and suddenly it's gone for 5 hours, people get unhappy. So all the anger suddenly is redirected to this guy. And they're like, well, stop blogging about this stuff because we need to, you know, post our cat pictures or whatever, right? It was a lot of anger, but then LiveJournal couldn't do anything. They said, well, you know, we have to delete you because, you know, like, all those cyber attacks wouldn't stop. So they actually deleted this guy, you know, said we have to suspend you temporarily until the attacks stop. He moved to a different platform. He moved to WordPress. Cyber attacks followed him there. So they had to delete him as well. So the guy became like a homeless, stateless blogger, whatever we can call him. So he had to migrate from a platform to platform. Nobody wanted to take him on, in part because there are no incentives for blogging platforms or for hosting companies to host such controversial stuff. You know, if I know that by hosting you, you know, I'll also attract, a million cyber attacks, well, you know, I just wouldn't host you. And it's this controversial projects usually have a reputation which follows them everywhere they go, right? So if I suddenly become, a stateless blogger, it meant that I've been forced off from many other platforms, and what's the rationale for me to do it? So that probably means that the traditional market forces of, I pay you $50 and you host me on your server for a year, they just don't work here. So we need, and again, it's a bigger issue here, but we need a platform where I would feel free expressing myself, knowing that cyber attacks wouldn't force me to shut up. And that, something that we can discuss maybe later.
You know, I'll just take this opportunity that Nancy Chang is here to. Nancy runs the National Security Campaign from the U.S. Programs, National Security and Human Rights. I'm just curious to hear, Nancy, if any of these issues have ever been on your agenda for the work that you guys are doing in the U.S. Certainly the whole kind of cybersecurity rubric has been one that's been well probed, beginning with Reagan. But certainly the Clinton initiative in its regard was quite controversial with respect to privacy concerns and the like. And I'm wondering, does this at all touch upon any of the work that you guys are up to?
No, I'm really welcome this opportunity to attend this because we hadn't been thinking along these lines. But I would love to get engaged with this set of issues.
Okay, maybe with that, you touch upon it, Jenny, just for a moment now, but if George Soros was listening to this, I'm wondering programmatically in his mind or in Ari Nair's mind, what the relevance might be for us at OSI. Mm-hmm. And is there a kind of, is it a question of privacy? Is there anything that the information program that you're engaged with mm-hmm. has thought through mm-hmm. in terms of any kind of intervention?
Sure. Well, basically, I think there are two big issues here. I mean, the first issue is the question of free speech and free expression, right? And again, this example of the Georgian blogger, I mean, he's not alone. I mean, there are many other projects, bloggers, voices, which suddenly, they imagine they have a big audience. They spend like 5 years building an audience, and then it basically, breaks down because they have to migrate from a URL to URL, and they lose like half of the readers in the process. So I think there is a very big freedom of expression issue here, particularly now that we see, I don't want to sort of say much about Burma since, we have more authoritative people in this room in Burma. But, also we see Chinese dissident websites under more and more cyber attacks. We see even Mauritania, actually had a very big campaign on dissent. It actually did have a cyber attack campaign on, dissident websites in Mauritania. To me, that sounds that's going mainstream, and we'll see more and more of that. And again, the problem here is that the market forces here don't really work. We do need a non-profit model with talented web administrators who would be able on a 24/7 basis monitor what's happening to content, because it requires a lot of brains, really. I mean, now that these attacks getting more and more sophisticated with peer-to-peer botnets, all of that, you do need talented people who would be on your case 24/7, who would be paid a salary, and you also need, vast serving space, which would otherwise cost you, $5,000 per hour. But if I'm a blogger and I have to pay $5,000 a year, I probably wouldn't blog, right? So there is a freedom of expression issue. There is also, I think, a big privacy issue here, and also sort of, if you can talk about a sort of digital liberties, because the more we hear about the cybersecurity developments with this market booming and with more and more people, we'll see, I guarantee in the next 2 or 3 years, we'll start having a debate on a need for greater identification online. So you would need to carry an ID to do online, you already carry an ID to do online banking, but a lot of transactions would require a much more secure environment than they require now. And, you know, in the American context, that may not be such a big problem, although, you know, we can debate that also. But, you know, in the Russian context, in the Chinese context, you know, this need to, and it would be a very interesting development with the government sort of being behind many of the cyber attacks, using the cyber attacks as an excuse, as a shield to sort of crack down on what you can actually do online by saying that we need to regulate it more, or you need to register somewhere to blog, or you need to, you know, enter an ID every time you use the internet. I mean, I don't know how many of you have actually browsed the internet in South Korea. In South Korea, you actually, when you leave a comment on a blog, you actually have to provide a state-approved ID, which is issued to you. So it's actually all very much transparent. Not that I have done it, but I know that exists. You know, so if we see that model being sort of adopted universally, I mean, I think it's not going to lead to anything good. So, you know, thinking more, and of course, there is this whole dimension, again, with, you know, civilians participating in cyber attacks and what it means in terms of international law. You know, right now, these attacks are not powerful enough, right, to overtake botnets. But imagine if, you know, we will find an activity in which ordinary civilians would be able to engage, which would be much more destructive than botnets. You know, guessing online banking passwords or whatever, you know, whatever it would be, you know, in the case of, you know, Russia, Georgia, Russia, Estonia, you know, then the question is, how would we go after the citizens, which may be based in Russia, may be based elsewhere? How? Because, I mean, they are criminals of sorts, whether they were criminals or not, you know, is a different question. But what would be the legal norms guiding this? So I think those three issues are more or less something to keep in mind.
I'd like to thank Zhenya very much for this phenomenal encyclopedic tour de raison of cyber warfare. I should say, for those of you interested in China, beginning the end of this week, we have a new fellow coming on board, Rebecca McKinnon, who's been based in Hong Kong for the last number of years, who is looking actually at questions of control and freedom of expression in the Chinese context. And she and Zhenya will offer a public discussion on the evening of February 10th about kind of control and coercion and new media here at OSI, which will perhaps have a...
Russia and China.
Well put. It'll be held here at OSI, but discussing Russia and China. So with that, thank you very much.